Hey, everyone. This is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9. Still coming at you live from the center of the universe here in gorgeous, fantastic Clear Creek County, Colorado, in the heart of the most gorgeous town, well, here, Idaho Springs, on this fantastic fall day. And this is the Rabbit Hole. And very blessed, fortunate, because we have a back-to-back authors on the Rabbit Hole today. The first hour, you were able to listen, if you did, with Molly Kate Brown about her work, Learning to Walk in India. And if you missed it, it will be repeated on Monday at 2 o'clock, and I believe on Thursday. But also, we'll have it uploaded to my website, along with this next hour here. We'll be visiting with Stan Moore in his works, the more historical in nature. Before we go on with the conversation here, and again, this is the Rabbit Hole, I do want to thank, well, I brought you the last hour, so, you know, certainly go check out my work if you haven't done it yet at jerryfabianic.com. This next hour is being brought to you by Dex. And if you have any information needs, 1-800 call Dex, I'm sorry, and or you can go to dexknows.com on the internet. So, but I want to thank all our sponsors, because without them, community radio like this and a show like this would not be possible, because we don't have all the corporate, people here. It's just us being who we are. So, all right. So in the studio with me is Stan Moore, and Stan is a third generation Coloradan and an avid reader of books, magazines, websites, and historical papers. Stan is a Vietnam vet, and he enjoys his family time with his wife, children, their spouses, and his grandchildren, friends. And when not reading up on today's and tomorrow's past, he is traveling, or more likely is outdoors, exploring mountains in Colorado, and the canyons in Utah are among Stan's favorite activities. Stan has three works out. I'm like, wow. You know, I'm looking at these here, and as an historical buff of sorts, I used to teach history, you know, I find them quite intriguing. The first one he put out, I think it was in 2011, 2012, was called Seesaw, How November 42 Shaped the Future. And that's a historical look at five campaigns during the crux month of World War II, with political, economic developments, with letters from participants. His next work is called Over the Dam, and it's a novel set in present-day Colorado addressing eco-terrorism, water, and civic issues. But his third one, the one we really want to concentrate on, but we're going to talk about all three here, is called Mr. Moffat's Road, and it is a gripping story about the building of Colorado's most famous railroad and how the state became what it is today. Well, Stan, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here, Jerry.
All right. And how was your journey up the hill from Denver?
Oh, just fine. Not a lot of traffic. Sailed right through today.
And you love being up in the mountains.
Oh, yes, very much. Every chance I get.
Yeah. Do you do a lot of hiking? You climb 14ers or anything?
Oh, I climb a lot of peaks, particularly the smaller peaks and valleys, lakes, things like that. I don't climb too many 14ers anymore. They're kind of crowded and... there's just a lot of other places to go right now.
Right. Yeah, it kind of loses its ambiance, if you will, when you're and, you know, 20,000 of your best friends are standing around at the top of Mount Albert.
Exactly. You know, there's so many smaller peaks and valleys and places where you see no one except maybe a coyote or an elk. That's my kind of country.
And you say you like to be out in the canyonlands of Utah.
Yes.
What areas did there have you gone?
Oh, gosh. The Navajo Reservation, the Dirty Devil Country, just over in the Little Rockies a week ago.
Where is that?
South of Hanksville, part of the Henry Mountains.
Okay.
Pretty much any place in Colorado, Utah, or Arizona that has slick rock country is fair game.
Yeah. Oh, man. So. And this is such a fantastic country. I remember a few years ago I came out of was Monticello, headed east into Colorado, and went down. And I mean, it's just stark country once you go into this, past the farms and everything. Yeah, you descend this valley. I mean, it is dark, and I just found it intriguing, beautiful.
Yes, it has a beauty of its own. It truly does. there's a lot of life out there. It's you need to be still and look for it a lot of times. Of course, Native Americans lived there for thousands of years. They've left a fair amount of evidence out in that country. So it's one of my favorite places to go in the spring and the fall.
And you have his passion, it seems, then. You're writing historical novels and actually history in World War II, your first work, Seesaw. The other ones are novels, so historical fiction, but they're primarily history. You have to be, you know, obviously very accurate with your details and, you know, so forth in there. Where do you think this comes from? Why do you love writing like this?
Well, I've always enjoyed the written word since I was a little kid. I mean, I'm one of those people, and I always was, read the back of the cereal box or you're painting, you're reading the articles in the newspapers, you're painting. So from that point of view, I've always enjoyed that, and I've always enjoyed history. History is not the names of battles and dead people. It's the intersection of personalities, place, and events. And it's fascinating. Nothing just happened. There's always a story behind anything that, you know, in the past, personalities and people trying to get something done. So that's always fascinating to me.
I love the way you put that there, because and you said the word, and to me it's the most magical word, is story, because it is a story, history, and it is a story of people, their stories, and, you know, it's just, and how many ways can... You know, if you and I start talking about maybe a person we both know, perhaps at our book group, for example, we might have different takes on it. Well, if you and I both write a biography of Abraham Lincoln, we might have different takes on him, too. They might be very similar, but I think someone from, you know, the South might have a different perspective on Abraham Lincoln compared to someone from the North.
Yes, that's true. It's in a way, it's very personal. I mean, you're bringing your own experiences as a lens to whatever you're telling, but every event has a number of causes and effects, and it's just fascinating to try to ferret those out and write them out in an understandable manner.
And you create characters for your novels, okay? So Over the Dam and Mr. Moffat's Road, they're fictional characters. Talk about how, why, where do these come from?
Well, Over the Dam, one day I just had the idea, the basic idea of the book, and I laid out a couple of characters, and then they, this sounds odd, but they really kind of take on a life of their own. Sometimes you're writing along, and one will say or do something, and I have to step back and think, wait a minute, where did this come from? I mean, the story flows and it comes together, but it really is interesting to me that they do take on a life of their own. Knowing, especially on Over the Dam, where it's pure fiction and you want to tell a story. Mr. Moffat's Road, that's a historical novel. The basic framework was history. I mean, it really happened, the small and the large events. But I did put in some characters to show what everyday life was like, or what I think it was like. Plus, in that case, my great-grandparents had a contract to provide meat and produce to one of the construction camps of the Moffat Road on the east side of El Dorado Mountain back in 1902. So we have letters and diaries, and I had family lore. I mean, I have stories about that from the time I was a munchkin. So the great-grandparents actually make a cameo in the book. But the characters, you know, Mr. Moffat and some others, historical characters, have a few lines in there, but by and large, it's either the fictional characters or other lesser people, lesser historic people who actually were around at the time and probably said the kinds of things that I have them saying.
When you're writing this, Dan, and I'm intrigued. For some reason, as you were describing this here, East of Eden by John Steinbeck jumped into mind. And it is set in that same time period, early 20th century, late 19th century. And, you know, and I think these characters, and I love that story. I think it's of Steinbeck's, well, that and Rings of Wrath. But these people are like alive to me. They're like real people. Yet we know they're not real people. He created them. You created in your story, too.
Yes.
When you're working with, let's say, and I haven't read your work yet, but there's an interaction between a character you created and let's say Mr. Moffat, who's a real historical person.
Yes.
What's that like as a writer that you can work with these characters, their thinking, their feelings, the dialogue you create for them? Are they easier? Are you more open? What's that?
Well, when you're dealing with a historic figure that we know a lot about, like David Moffat, I'm trying to bring forth something that he thought or the way his personality was. Mm-hmm. And once or twice there's an actual quote. A lot of times I'm you know, saying this is the kind of thing that David Moffat would have said. And in that case, usually the fictional character is a foil to bring that out.
Okay.
There's not a lot of heavy emotional or day-to-day reaction interaction between my characters and David Moffat. It's when he's talking about, you know, we're behind schedule or the road's got to go this way or whatever it happens to be.
Right. So. Yeah, it's something that it drives me, and that's that it's a psychological concept of the archetype, and these characters take on a certain energy character, you know, so the simplistic way is a good guy to bad guy, you know, in that way. But we also know that not everybody is truly good, not everybody's truly evil, that there's, you know,
everybody's got a little of both, you know,
exactly.
Some more than others, but yeah, that's right.
And some are more nurturing, others are more standoffish, whatever it might be. They're just real people. You create characters, though, in your work that are fictional, yet interact. Why? What do you do with those? What's your point in when you're doing this in context of an otherwise historically accurate
Well, you're trying to drive the story on Mr. Moffat's road. David Moffat faced a number of political and economic barriers, as well as just driving a railroad through the Rocky Mountains, which is barrier enough for most anybody. Mm-hmm. But he had physical, like I said, financial and economic problems as well. So I wanted to bring those out. But as you tell the story, and I wanted to bring out what life was like every day, you know, you need to have a conflict drives, you know, drives life for that matter. It certainly drives a story. So, and it doesn't need to be, you know, like you say, black and white. I mean, everyone has shades of gray, and everybody has an annoying attitude or an annoying, you know, habit or something like that, which you can use to springboard for something sometimes. Mm-hmm. Characters are, well, the more conflict or the more subtleties you can build into them, I think the better. And the more, you know, good and bad, like you say. We have one character in Mr. Moffat's Road who is basically a troublemaker and almost a paid thug. But she has a soft spot for animals being mistreated, and she'll go out of her way even to damage her own efforts at business to go help an animal. Mm-hmm. Things like that.
Yeah. And you bring out then the culture, what was it like to live in 1902 in Colorado in the mountains? And, you know, which is a very specific experience, a place, okay? Mm-hmm. So we're not in the South, so it's colder. It's isolated. People go out and, you know, if this is the dream, you know, I'm going to discover gold, you know, pan for gold or whatever, and I'm going to get rich, I'm going to do all these things here. And then you get into the real hard work of life.
Yes, many, many people who came out here turned around and came back within 6 weeks, went back to Illinois River they came from because it was so difficult.
Yeah.
It's interesting writing about that because I'm even now forever catching myself saying, wait, that expression didn't exist or that concept didn't exist, like snapshot the phrase okay. Nobody said okay in 1902.
Ah, yeah.
You know, those kinds of things. So that's in a way, it's a minor, but it's actually, if you want to be genuine, you're not going to be, you've got to be aware of that kind of a thing. One thing that I point out in the book, and is truly I think, important. The railroad truly eased the life of people when it came close, when it came by. Mm-hmm. It eased transport. It eased, everything from the telling of time. You know, standard time came about because the railroads are going across the country so fast. So there was an agreement, all right, let's have these time zones. It improved diet, it improved health, improved certainly travel and spread of ideas. I mean, if you look at people who lived, say, in El Dorado Springs in 1900, if they went to Denver, it was a full day's project to get there.
Right.
So if they had business down there, they were gone for 3 or 4 or 5 days.
Right.
When the train came, suddenly it was, you know, 2.5, maybe 3 hours to Denver. And that's an awful lot of time freed up for other productive uses if you can get to where you're going in 3 hours instead of a full day.
Right. And that's with that whole industrial period, not in transportation, but also communication, and these other aspects that things became easier and faster. You know, start having running water in a home, for example. Telephones were being created.
Yes,
and strung.
Telephone, telegram. The internal combustion engine was coming along. The airplane was in its infancy.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting thing about that period around 1900, 1880 and 1900, it was the Gilded Age. Now, we hear a lot about the 1%ers today, but the Gilded Age, you had probably half the wealth of the entire country locked up in about half a dozen families.
Mm-hmm.
They had their trusts, which basically big holding companies, and they would do pretty much whatever it took to build that trust up. Even going so far as to lie and to manipulate each other, much less, you know, the common man on the street. And these are people with, you know, $100-200 million in the days when people like you and me were living on $600 a year.
Right.
So there was an awful lot more inequality in those days than there is today. Not to minimize what we've got today, but that was truly, truly a phenomenon.
And when I think of the Gilded Age, when I would teach that period, the writer that I would most focus on, there was Bret Hart and others, but Mark Twain, he really coined that concept of the Gilded Age.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he was scathing in his writing, and yet he wasn't one of the 1%ers, but he wasn't exactly poor either.
Yeah,
he did pretty well.
Did well for himself, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, of course, that's the American way. I mean, you know, to this day, if you can make it big or make it well, hey, more power to you.
Mm-hmm.
Without stepping on people, that's what it's all about. Improve your life.
When you're doing your research for this particular work here and others, where do you go? And do you use, would you read Mark Twain? You use literal historical documents from that time? You talked about your grandparents, great-grandparents being active in there.
Mm-hmm.
You start to draw on. What's that like for you to, before you can literally start to create the work, you have to do a lot of background work, it seems.
Yes, you do. Particularly if you're looking at writing about things 100 years ago when life was tremendously different. Works of the era, a lot of newspapers, going back and just reading the newspapers and getting a flavor of what was news, what went on, how were things presented. In terms of the railroad, the industry, there's a lot of documentation on that in terms of what was built and how and when and so forth. Family, like I said, family documents. I found for all my books, if I can get some letters or diaries of people who were actually there at the time, that's very valuable. Because it gives an insight at the time as to how things looked to somebody. And they were writing for themselves generally, not for posterity, so they're going to be brutally honest and, not with an eye over their shoulder who's going to be reading this. I don't think anybody will be reading it.
They weren't worried about WikiLeaks coming in.
Ah, yes.
That sort of thing. Okay, so let's talk specifically now when we talk about the railroad. specifically which railroad? Was it the Union Pacific, Moffett Tunnel? Give the literal historical story that this is built on.
Okay, Mr. Moffett's Road. Well, David Moffett came to Denver as a young man, got involved in banking, was president of the First National Bank, owned a number of mines and other, and was on the board of another railroad from the 1880s on until they had a falling out with him in the late 80s, early 90s, was basically fired. But he had a lot of money. He had a personal fortune in 1900 of roughly $11 million. And again, no income tax, no OSHA, no capital gains. So a lot of money. And he was very active in Denver civic affairs. He was big owner in Denver Water, Denver Union Water Company, the Denver Tramway Company, a lot of other civic affairs. He decided that he wanted to build a standard gauge railway from Denver to Salt Lake City. Because at that time, well, in 1869, when the Union Pacific came through, they pretty much bypassed Colorado. They avoided the mountains. Denver was off the grid for a while. In 1870, they managed to build a railroad from Denver to Cheyenne, so they were on the national grid. Denver has always prided itself on being a hub. And so Mr. Moffett, in 1902, formed the Denver Northwest Pacific Railway Company, going to build from Denver straight through to Salt Lake City. Up to that point, most of the railways that had come in Colorado had followed the traditional routes, the Native American routes, which became wagon routes, which became railways, which became interstates. If you look, I-70 follows the Smoky Hill route, basically. The Kansas Pacific Railway follows US 50, which is the Santa Fe Trail.
Okay.
So Mr. Moffett did something a little different. He was going to, rather than follow a traditional route, he was going to put it basically straight line, not literally, but through the countryside, whatever the barriers, from Denver to Salt Lake City. And as I mentioned, he had a lot of barriers besides just building a railroad. He went east, lined up financing, announced he was going to build this railroad, and a week later his financing was pulled because one of the Gilded Age, Edward Harriman, didn't want a competing railroad 70 miles south of his Union Pacific. So he leaned on the finance community and said, I don't want you to loan any money to Moffett, period, end of story. They yanked his financing and he had to use his own money. But he made good progress. Starting in June 1902, they got the railway up across El Dorado Mountain, clear up to where what is now the east portal of the Moffett Tunnel by September 1904. The thinking at that point was, we'll build a railway up and over the Continental Divide, Rollins Pass, use it for a couple of years while we're driving a tunnel through the Continental Divide. And so they built it on up and over, got the railway out to Craig, Colorado, where there were coal beds. And that's one thing Moffett wanted to do, is get access to that coal so he could haul it back to Denver and make some money doing that. And he got that far. But the conditions on the Rollins Pass were so difficult it ate up every bit of profit of the railway. Moffett never had the money to build the Moffett Tunnel. He died basically broke. But, you know, the Rollins Pass is the Continental Divide there is basically the furthest east it is anywhere in North America. And it's low. It acts as a natural funnel for winds, big drifts of snow, tremendous weather problems. I mean, they were having trains shoved off the tracks by snow slides and big drifts that were so deep that the rotary plows couldn't get through them. They had to send men out to dig the snow down so it was only 12 feet deep so they could get the rotary plow through to open up the tracks. Derailments. It was just a very difficult environment. So that's why there was literally no money left to build the tunnel. Moffett had been... He was dead 15 years before the tunnel was completed, actually. Wow. And he took tax money to do it.
Yeah. Oh, that's what a great story. And I was thinking while you were describing that, Stan, about how the wagon trains, for example, would follow the Native American trails that they had already. But he went on his own there and a different, because, and he didn't You know, and there's probably a good reason why the Native Americans did not do, you know, I mean, it's one thing to walk over that in the summer. I've been up in that area mm-hmm. there at the Indian Peaks Wilderness, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But to this day, if you want to get from Boulder to Winter Park to go skiing, guess what you're going to do is go all the way down to I-70. You're going to loop around and go all the way up to Fort Collins. You're not going to go across mm-hmm. Warlands Pass.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay. And yeah. there's a good reason for that, for you just described, with the snow, the winds, and everything, even yes. though it's low relatively yeah. to the rest of the divide.
Yeah. That's about all it has going for it.
It's beautiful.
Yes, it that's
is,
true.
It is fantastic it there. Is. And the tunnel itself, now, you see, I didn't know that. So the tunnel, and how long is the tunnel? The
tunnel is 6.2 miles.
6.2, okay.
If you go up there today, you hear a train coming. There are huge fans that are moving air through there to pull the diesel exhaust out. Uh-huh. That was actually quite an engineering, a technological feat. Mm-hmm. It didn't start; they didn't start building until 21 or 22, mm-hmm. But it's still in use. It happens. My wife and I were just through there a couple of days ago on the train, and to this day, they say when you go on the tunnel, stay in the car you're in. Don't go between cars because that will allow diesel fumes and even leftover coal dust from the coal days into the cars.
Wow!
So. It's okay. still a bit of an issue. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting story about the Moffett Tunnel because, of course, Moffett started the Denver Northwest Pacific in 1902. But at that time, the main way to get to the western slope was narrow gauge road, Denver to Pueblo, Pueblo to Salida, Salida partway up Poncha Pass, over Marshall Pass to Gunnison, down partway through the Black Canyon, over to Montrose, out to Grand Junction, then west. 2-day trip. Mm-hmm. Pueblo loved it because they had rail yards, they had people coming through and spending the night. You know, it's a real economic driver.
Sure. It's like being on the interstate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Same kind of a thing. And after Moffett died in 1911, actually his railway went into receivership and was reformed as the Denver-Salt Lake Railroad. And there was thought that we're going to need to get the state behind this and have them guarantee some bonds to build the tunnel because that really is a very efficient way to get to the western slope mm-hmm. and on. Pueblo roadblocked that. Their state legislators wouldn't let bills to that effect come to the floor, and they were very, very hostile to it, looking after their own rice bowl, so to speak.
Sure.
Well, in 1921, there was a... one of those rainstorms up above Pueblo, you know, 4 inches in 35 minutes, just on the Arkansas, maybe 10 miles upstream from Pueblo. Huge flood came down, wiped out a good bit of Pueblo. Mm. It was a terrible flood. A lot of people died, a lot of destruction. But a deal was cut in the legislature at that point. The state would provide some money to help Pueblo rebuild from this flood if Pueblo would get behind some kind of a taxing authority to build a tunnel. Mm-hmm. So a deal was cut. Work started on the tunnel in 22 or 23. I'd have to look, tell you exactly. And it was put through using bonds guaranteed by the state and a taxing authority. We had the Moffett Tunnel Commission up until about 20 years ago. Every county the railroad goes through, Denver, Jefferson, Boulder, Grand, and so forth on up to Craig, had a sales tax. Those bonds were all paid off about 15 years ago, and finally the Moffett Tunnel Commission was disbanded because it was all paid off. But that's the story of the Moffett Tunnel. There was fairly good geology, fairly solid rock most of the way through that. There was one spot where there's some... And a geologist has explained this to me. I'm not sure I understand, but some kind of soft rock that when it hit air, it expanded and caused problems. So finally, they had to encase that section, a couple hundred yards of the tunnel, with concrete, mm-hmm. and that stopped it. And it's in use now to this day.
Wow. This is intriguing. I'm loving it. And I want to remind our listening audience, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LP FM 102.7. 103.9, and visiting here with Stan Moore, excuse me, the author of Mr. Moffett's Road and a couple other works, including Seesaw, How November of 42 Shaped the Future, and Over the Dam. Want to thank Dex for sponsoring this hour. And if you need any information, DexKnows.com or 1-800-CALL-DEX. And just a reminder that the show will be rebroadcast on Monday, but also recorded and loaded up to my website. And so you'll be able to listen to it there at jerryfabianic.com. And when you're talking about this, Stan, it also, I put it in context because a few weeks, a couple of shows ago, Anna Marie Wasman, and she wrote a book about the Ludlow massacre that took place in 1914. And not to get into that particular story, we already had that conversation then, but I'm intrigued by the Colorado of 100 years ago compared to now, the Colorado of today, and what a difference, and yet how much is still the same.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought, because Colorado 115 years ago was very much an industrial, extractive industries-based economy. I mean, we had coal mining, we had Colorado Fuel and Iron, we had gold, silver, tungsten, all the metals.
And Clear Creek is silver and gold. Yeah, Argo mines right here.
Sure, yeah. I mean, this was the epicenter. This is where it started, really, 1859. And that really drove our economy for quite a while, until probably 50s, something like that. Okay. And I've heard people complain about the extractive economy and all the damage that it did to this state. Okay. But I think our recreation economy wouldn't be nearly as strong as it is if we hadn't had that, because we had railroads and logging roads going up into all the places which are now ski areas and wilderness areas where you can hike them. An awful lot of the trails are on old logging or mining roads. Mm-hmm. And it opened up the country. We know what's in there. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that every 14 or every high 13 in the state was first climbed by a prospector who was looking for a load for ore, you know.
Sure.
So it was different in many ways, but it echoes today. There are many, we're reaping the benefits as well as some of the problems that have come from the extractive industries and the mining that we had here.
Yeah, and you know, we're looking at it there in terms of economy and environment, but one of for my money, is that Colorado is still the land of opportunity. It's a place people come to, you know, even if it's to be in the ski area or whatever. People come here. Mm-hmm. At my last guest here, Molly K. Brown, you're a third generation Coloradan. Molly and I are both immigrants.
Mm-hmm. We're all here by choice.
Yeah, we're here by choice. Yeah, you were born here, you stayed. We come here, and people still are coming. I mean, mm-hmm. the population growth here from out of state is incredible there. But it is this opportunity to come here for dreams.
Yeah, I mean, the mindset, you know, I think it really is open to new ideas. And now a lot of technology and the Internet of Things, and how can we get people to work together easier with this technology? And I think it's great.
Yeah, and it's not wedded to, you know, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, where it's far more working class, ethnic, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I tell the story of this town I went to high school in. Mm-hmm. It's called Braddock, Pennsylvania. And within a mile, you walk down the street, Braddock Avenue, and within 1 mile, you would come across six different Catholic churches.
Ah, okay.
One for the Polish, one for the Slovaks, one for the Irish, and oh my God, and you better go. Yeah, of course, that's, you know. But a whole different culture here in the West and in Colorado, and it is more expansive to me, more open, you know, and I think the land helps that shape that, because we are spaced.
That's interesting, because that's one of the things I really enjoy about this part of the country is the views. Mm-hmm. When I have to go back to the Midwest or the East for one reason or another, I get almost claustrophobic because, you know, the trees are coming up all around you and you can't see, but 300 yards or something like that, if that. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy the views, and I think you're right. There's an open attitude here because there are so many new people and so many new ideas and new things being developed here mm-hmm. that, you know, I mean, you just don't have that kind of, we've always done it that way, and, you know,
right.
kind of an attitude.
Yeah.
I don't think you. Yeah. I don't think.
That's, I think it would be intriguing to read your work, you know, that's set, you know, a century ago mm-hmm. in the exact same spot we're living now. It's mm-hmm. Colorado, and Moffitt's not that far away from here. And, you know, we're up in Clear Creek and you're right in Denver. It's mm-hmm. all, we're in the epicenter of the whole thing, is mm-hmm. the term you used earlier. Mm-hmm. And to think about what was life like then for those people. You say it was heavily dependent upon the extraction industry. It was very industrialized. Mm-hmm. Pueblo, steel mills, et cetera.
Yes.
And compared to today, when it's more of a recreational, high-tech and tourist-driven mm-hmm. economy.
Yeah, but you know, I was talking to my dad about this once. He's been gone 20 years. But I asked him as a young man, well, how did you get along in the 1930s? You know, you didn't have TV. You didn't have this, you didn't have that. And he kind of laughed and said, yeah, but what we had was the best we had, and it was good stuff for us, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's relative to some degree because, mm-hmm. I mean, the motor car and the airplane, even in 1930, was a heck of an improvement over, you know, what you had in the 1890s, for instance, sure. you know.
Yeah.
So it's different, but it's the same because – we're still dealing with whatever we've got, and it's as good as it is, and boy, isn't it good.
Well, and that's why it's just beautiful to read works like yours that put us back into that time. As I said, I read that work mm-hmm. About the Ludlow massacre and putting myself there mm-hmm. in Ludlow. What was it like to be in those mining camps
mm-hmm.
and the harsh conditions and so forth, and to be paid in script and not dollars,
mm-hmm.
and you were completely dependent on the company store. Mm-hmm. You're essentially indentured servants is mm-hmm. what it was. You
That's
know.
True. That's
you
true.
Define it however you want. You're not a slave. You can always leave, but even then you risk.
Yeah, then what? That's right.
You know,
you're right.
So, you know, and where we were and where we are today, and I think it's important for us, you know, to appreciate where we are, and then, you know, in our own culture, and what can we do better, you know, to, you know, keep improving who we mm-hmm. are as a people and society.
Well, I see what you're saying. I was saying in terms of the technology, but in terms of social development, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's always room for improvement, and just because we've done it some, you know, or they did it that way in 1902, well, maybe it made sense then, but, you know, let's take another look at what we've got now. And frankly, I think we're seeing a revolution with that, with globalization and with the technology. I mean, I was hiking with a great nephew a couple of years ago, and we were talking, and he made about doing something, I don't remember, but he said, well, we're just going to have the machines do it. And it kind of brought me up short. This kid's 17, mm-hmm. but he's right. You look at things that machines can do now that even you and I, growing up, we had no concept of this kind of a thing happening.
Yeah.
So it interesting times that we're in.
It's wondrous, you know, to look at, and, you know, your point earlier about history not being just a litany of people who lived and died and mm-hmm. dates, and this battle took place, and that's what we end up teaching in school to mm-hmm. Instead of really teaching the authentic, what was it like for these people and how mm-hmm. we are, why we are here the way we are, the reason we're here where we are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it started there. What was that revolution, evolution that moved us to this time and place mm-hmm. here now? So
mm-hmm.
Let's move over, because I'm intrigued about your work there over the dam, because, you know, we're talking Colorado history,
mm-hmm.
You know, getting under the mountain there, you know, mm-hmm. to get the railroad.
Yeah.
And now you're bringing something that's real life today, and that's mm-hmm. eco-terrorism. Let's talk a little bit more about that. We mentioned it earlier in the show.
Well, like I said, the novel is set, and it's a pure novel set in present-day Colorado, actually in the mountains not that far from here, Summit County, basically, Summit County, Denver, that area.
Okay.
Talking about some people who want to do some significant damage to the social fabric. Just because, well, that's a good question. Why do you do that? Is it because you're enraged or because you feel it's really wrong and needs to be set right? How far do you go? What's appropriate? What's not? How far do you go to stop it? So those issues are, it's around those issues as well as the use of water and how basically Denver established itself as the primary city in the state and has been appropriating water, you know, since 1870 or something like that, a long time. And what effects is that having throughout the rest of the state? Now, I've noticed recently that Denver Water is talking with entities around the state about what, you know, minimum stream flows and what can we do to get along, which I think is good. But Denver takes an awful lot of the water from a good bit of the state. I'm not saying whether that's good or bad. I'm just saying that's what we've got. And if you have characters or people who are concerned about that, what are they going to do about it?
Right.
So,
and I harken back, though, to Mr. Moffitt's Road, because we have the Moffitt Tunnel, and then that's a, you know, the feeding of the water, and the water comes out of Summit County. Can't remember the name of the dam, or not the dam, but the portal, the tunnel that comes out. I think it's over in Park County.
Well, yeah, that's the Roberts Tunnel. It comes from the Dillon Reservoir, yes,
right.
Over into South Platte.
And this idea of water rights. And when we talk as Coloradans, we talk about water rights. Mm-hmm. We get it. Talk to someone in the East, and they go, what's that?
Mm-hmm. You know, you find that most of the states in the West have something similar because it was devised by miners who were pretty much the first on the scene, the first not Europeans on the scene, mm-hmm. who were using a lot of water, and they got together and figured out, much like Colorado, okay, you first to use it, it's yours until you don't use it. You find it pretty similar in Montana, Idaho, Utah, places like that. It made sense at the time. Again, does it now? Well,
but you know. the reality is that our life here in the West, or existence environmentally, ecologically, compared to the East, is that water is a precious, limited commodity here.
Yes, it is. And we, at least in Denver, the lawns are, I mean, sometimes I wonder, does it make sense to have a lawn like an English manor when we're living in a place that gets 15 inches of rain a year?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly right. Yeah. And, you know, so we have to build these big dams and reservoirs, et cetera, mm-hmm. because of just our environment itself.
Yeah.
And we have
That's
to.
That's right.
And then what repercussions are, I shouldn't say repercussions, but, you know, the what does that portend for the future? If we keep, population keeps growing, and only X amount of water, moisture, falls on the state mm-hmm. within a 100-year average. Mm-hmm. Now, we know about climate change, that could shift. We might even get wetter. Who knows?
Yeah, that's true.
On the other hand, it starts driving out. You know, that Kentucky bluegrass all of a sudden
It may have to go. Or, you know, or maybe somebody will invent a really cheap way to desalinate the ocean and we'll have pipelines coming in the Pacific over here.
Yeah.
Who knows? I mean, we have invented ourselves out of way of an awful lot of problems.
Right.
That may be another one we do. I don't know. Again, that's just kind of blue sky. What if?
Yeah. Well, that's what I think. Again, you know, it's intriguing to read works like yours, whether it's set 100 years ago, Mr. Mm-hmm. Moffitt's Road, or Over the Dam, which is, you know, within
today,
it's current, mm-hmm. that the complexity of our lives and that, the lessons that we have to learn if we're going to survive and leave the world, you know, when we're done, because mm-hmm. we're really just placeholders holding it, you know, hand it off to the next generation, your children, grandchildren, mm-hmm. great-grandchildren, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What kind of world are we leaving them?
Well, that's always a question that should be asked whenever, before major actions are taken, mm-hmm. you know.
Wow.
I agree with that. Denver Water, they've done a lot of good things. They have a very, very long planning horizon. I mean, they, around the 1910, 1920s, they were already taking water rights up here in Summit County. Matter of fact, the Moffitt Tunnel the pilot bore of the Moffett Tunnel, first one that was put through maybe a 12-foot diameter just to check the geology and see what was going on. It's leased to the Denver Water Board, and they ship water east to Denver through that from the Williams Fork and the Summit County area. So a good bit of the water that we drink in Lakewood or Orvat or wherever comes through the pilot bore of the Moffett Tunnel.
And Grand County. Yes. Winter Park, because there's that Fraser River.
Yes, the Fraser River.
That is highly controversial
there. Yes, good point.
Water, you know, Denver taking more out of it, and the fish kill, et cetera. Mm-hmm. As I work over there in Grand County at Winter Park, Mary Jane, uh-huh. And the locals there, I mean, it's ongoing, again, water rights, wars, et cetera, to this day.
Yeah, and it's not just the Denver. I mean, the Big Thompson takes a lot of water from the headwaters of the Colorado River and ships it over to Loveland, and a good bit of that water is being sold to developers.
Yeah,
it's not being used for agriculture as much anymore. A lot of it still is, but, you know, again, who are we to, I mean, my family happens to have been here for 130, 140 years, but who am I to say you can't move here now? Because, you know, I mean, that's the other side of that question.
You know, there are limits and stuff like it, but that's, you know, and that's not to get into the political, social, you know, it's just that it's not one thing. It's not an easy thing. And by studying history and through, and that's what I loved when I was teaching, using historical fiction to bring a situation alive. And I would do that, you know, so if I'm teaching the Great Depression, what better work than Steinbeck's
Grapes of Wrath.
Grapes of Wrath there.
Yeah. You know. I think good historical fiction does that. It sets out what really happened, but it puts it in human terms, understandable terms. Not, you know, I mean, if you're talking about how a family lives or tries to do the long day to day, it's much more clear than just reading statistics or that kind of a thing.
It would be kind of fun when I read Mr. Moffat's work, for Mr. Moffat's Road, that work, which of your characters are more relatable to me as a person, Mr. Moffat, David Moffat himself, or these fictional ones that you created? You know, that
I'll be interested to talk with you about that down the road.
Yeah.
I will.
That's great stuff.
It's just fun to work with those characters. They take on life of their own, as I've said, and I've had conversations with people about several of these books, and they'll either point out things or say, "Well, I like this person because so and so," which honestly hadn't maybe occurred to me, but I can see why they think that. You know, but that's a really a fun part of talking with people about my books.
Yeah. Oh, I hear you. Yeah, and then it comes back, and it's something you never even thought of. You just wrote it, and there it was, and it just resonated for it. And I think that's the beauty of literature, good literature, and, you know, good fiction, you know, so when you create these characters, because they are identifiable, you know, relatable, you know, to the reader in different ways. And,
people.
You know, ones that don't resonate with you as the writer strongly, and it's like, ooh, where'd that come from? It's like, okay, well, I'm glad I did, you know.
Yeah. Well, glad you're enjoying that,
So if people like to, and I'm sure they will, want to get your work, where can they go? How can they find it, et cetera?
Barnes & Noble, Tattered Cover, Amazon, other bookstores around. If you don't see it, ask for it. It's can be ordered.
Okay. Yeah. So we have Mr. Moffat's Road.
Yes.
Okay. Over the Dam.
Over the Dam.
Okay. And then the World War II story.
Yeah, Seesaw, November 42, Shape the Future, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Strongly encourage people. I just like, I eat this stuff up when I'm going to like, you know, why put on the television? This stuff is fabulous.
Yes. Yeah. The written word, you know, opens up all kinds of avenues and imagination. It truly does.
Right on. Yeah. Okay, well, Stan, thanks for coming up. Thanks for sharing your story and your writing. Once again, this is Stan Moore's been visiting with me here, Jerry Fabianic, on the Rabbit Hole and Writer's Talk here. So he's just talked about all three of his works. But again, go to Amazon or Tattered Covers, he said. Barnes & Noble has them as well. And certainly encourage you to do that. So
I'm working on not exactly a sequel, but a follow-on to Mr. Moffat's Road now about building and operating the road over Rollins Pass and some other business things were going on in Colorado at that time as well.
So you're doing some research on that right now and so forth.
Have a first draft done,
Okay. So when, looking forward to that next year?
Yeah, it's going to be mid-next year, I would think, something like that.
All right. Well, right when you're pulling the trigger on that one, you'll be back.
Sounds good to me. Oh,
yeah.
Sounds good to me, Jerry.
All right. Sounds good. And you picked up your book here, and I was going to ask you to read an excerpt from it. We still got a few minutes. Would you like to share something from?
Sure.
This is from Mr. Moffat's Road. We got some time. So.
Yeah, this is Mr. Moffat's Road. A couple of characters that have to work together, don't really trust or like each other, but find a way to do it. Okay, here we go. The men ended the handshake, both glad to be in an amiable working relationship. They walked out of the lobby and paused at the street. Mick had given their actions some thought. In fact, he had not slept very well for dreaming of the morning's challenges. He had a plan. Joe, we need to act like we're deep in discussion. That way we can walk right by him and don't have to notice him. We want him to think we don't see him, that he has tricked us. But I want to know where he is, and I want to be sure that he sees us. What do we do if he doesn't see us or if he's gone? Mick glanced both ways and stepped out across the street. I guess we'll have to make a ruckus or something. We can start a spirited discussion or argument or something. We'll figure that out as we go. Hopefully he's awake and on the lookout. As usual, the station was noisy and crowded. Passengers were sitting, standing, talking, waiting for loved ones to arrive or for their trains to load and depart. Some poor souls were stretched out on the floor, pretending that they were resting. Uniformed train men came through pulling carts loaded with baggage, barking to make way. Bells rang, and the station master periodically bellowed announcements. Clerks chalked, erased, and rechalked arrival and departure times. It looked chaotic. Actually, it was well organized, and things ran predictably and smoothly. It was a good example of American organizational and industrial might. The two men paused briefly at the door. They were looking for Dale, but trying not to be obvious about it. Mick saw him fumbling around, gathering his stuff, in the same spot as the previous evening. He said as much to Joe as they waited the crowds and joined the ticket line. A railroad ticket line in 1903 was a lowest common denominator experience. One met and saw all types of people while waiting to buy a ticket to ride the Iron Rooster. Mick was reminded of the DMV office a century later, waiting in line to renew your driver's license.
I like that. Yeah, and history repeats itself, only in a little different format.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the hustle and bustle, and just move from that particular railway station to DIA.
That's true. That's true. Very, very similar in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's people coming and going. You wonder where everybody's going.
And we're still human.
Yeah,
and,
go for it.
We're doing the same thing. Stuff like that. So that's awesome. All right. Okay. Well, once again, thanks, Dan. Really
my pleasure.
Appreciate
Thank you.
Coming in. And so remind everyone, again, this is Jerry Fabian, KYGT, LPFM, 102.7, 103.9. I will be back in a couple of weeks. And for the life of me, I can't remember. I do this all the time. I know who I have coming. And then I just like, whoop, kiss about it. I will be on in a couple of weeks, and I have at least one author, if not two. And I'm looking forward to that conversation as well. So in the meantime, let's keep enjoying this gorgeous weather up here. Be kind to one another. Let's de-stress from the campaign, the election, everything. Mark your ballots. Send them in. That way you're done. You don't have to keep worrying about it. You made your call. It's over. So that's your first and most important duty to me as an American citizen is to vote. That's your one responsibility. So please do. All right. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, we'll just hear some music and take care.